Today's koan comes from the book, The Transmission of Light, Denko Roku, case number 4, The Venerable Upagupta. In this particular collection, we only deal with the case, so the circumstances and the teisho and the verse. The verse we do use as a koan as well, but the circumstances and the teisho, that's just an add-on. Just a little bit of background on the Denko Roku. So we have a few new people here, and generally on koans. If you would have listened to the lectures which are on the website, that goes into some details about the purpose of koans and why we use koans. I just like to say that every koan, as I always say, every koan is really about the same thing. It's about awakening. Somehow we need to see whether we can actually see and somehow get it, whatever it is that has been tried to be conveyed. Now, awakening has many, many different forms, and that's why koans have so many different forms. But ultimately, there's just one thing, which is awakening, you know, or non-duality, or enlightenment, or there's all, or our true nature, or there's all sorts of different words that we use for it. So in that sense, every koan is about mu. Every koan is about this, what is this whole practice all about? You know, so to unpack a koan, which I'm going to do, is what we need to do, of course, when we become students. We, you know, the process is that, first of all, we need to have a breakthrough in order to even start the koan. We need to somehow get some reference point of what this is. Without this reference point, it is just an intellectual exercise. So the first thing is to get this reference point. And then once we have that reference point, that doesn't mean we're clear. It means that we then need to somehow, you know, brush away more and more dust in order to see it, in order to see that there is no dust, that all the dust is just something that we just keep on accumulating. But ultimately, there's no such thing. And eventually, when we really get that, that there is no dust, you know, that is the process that we go through. So here, this is probably the fourth book in our collection. Each book has about 100 koans. This is a very interesting book. It's called Transmission of Light. So the light meaning enlightenment is meaning the light. What is it? What is it actually? Why are we doing this? You know, transmission of light is what this is all about. You know, somehow getting it. That's the light. We see out of the darkness, we see the light. We wake up. It's another way of looking at it. So it's a lovely name. In Japanese, it's called Denko Roku. So the way this collection came about was because Master Kaizen, a 12th century monk in the Soto tradition in Japan, he had a problem in that the legitimacy of Soto was challenged by the hierarchy, the political hierarchy. So he needed to somehow establish some legitimacy for his entire Soto order. Now, all other religious traditions rely on documents. They rely on dogma. They rely on something they can say, this is it, like the Bible, here it is. Or the Pali canon, here it is. Or the Tibetan canon, here it is. But Zen has, Zen has made it its purpose not to be attached to any type of canon. So what are we actually attached to, if you can say that? And that was Kaizen's dilemma. How am I going to legitimize this without having proof? Because proof is, what is proof? What's a piece of paper? So this was his challenge. So what he did was he went right back to his transmission. They call it transmission, his lineage. And he documented how the light was transmitted all the way from Buddha through generations and generations, all the way to his master, which is one just after Dogen. Okay. So that's what he did. And, when I first heard this and when I first looked at it, I said, how can anyone possibly go back and know how this was transmitted 2,500 years ago? Like, it seems incredible, you know. How would they even know that, you know? And it's a legitimate question. So what's important is not whether this is authentic or not, even though the more I look into that, the more I see authenticity. but it's actually to see what we get, whether we can see it. That's the important part. It's like a legend. A legend has necessarily nothing to do with the truth, but it somehow survived. And it's far more, it's much, much more interesting than the truth. The truth hasn't survived if the legend has survived, because the legend is what has survived. What is the legend? Diving into that, unpacking it, in many ways, is just as interesting as the truth. The truth is just a concept, just like a legend is anyway. You know, so don't get necessarily, don't hold yourself back because of, you know, of the years that have passed since we're talking about this, since since what is basically being looked at in this koan. So here, this is case number four. So in other words, four generations past the Buddha. So we're still talking 3rd century BCE, before the Common Era, before Christ. Okay, so the year 300 before Christ, this is how far back this goes. So the first, obviously, the first person that started this whole thing was, you know, as we always say, the origin point of Buddhism is the experience of the Buddha, his awakening experience. That started this whole thing up. Without that, we wouldn't be sitting here. Then the next one was Mahakashyapa. You know, we all know the story. We've given koans, teishos about that. Mahakashyapa, he was handed the transmission from the Buddha. In other words, he was told, yes, you got it. You can now go and teach. Then the next one after that was Ananda. Ananda, those of you that know Buddhism, he was Buddha's attendant for many years. He, you know, when we, for those of you that may read the actual canon or the Buddha's doctrines, thus I have heard is always comes from Ananda. Thus I have heard. Ananda has had amazing memory, and he recollected whatever he heard, and that became the canon. First the Pali canon, then of course it was translated into Tibetan and then Chinese. So there are these three major canons now, which interestingly you can now so many parallels there. But there's also some discrepancies as well. So the fourth patriarch here, if you look at the lineage chart, is the one after a person called Shanavasa. So Shanavasa was the monk. Those days they were all monks that received the transmission from Ananda. Okay, so Ananda from Mahakashyapa, Mahakashyapa from the Buddha. So number four. So that's what we're dealing with. So I'll just read out the case. The fourth patriarch was the Venerable Upagupta. He attended Shanavasa for 3 years. So he was his attendant. And then shaved his head and became a monk. Once the Venerable Upagupta asked him, "Did you make your home departure physically or in spirit?" And the master replied, "Truly, I made my home departure physically." The Venerable Upagupta said, "How can the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas have anything to do with body or mind?" On hearing this, the master was greatly awakened. So let's just go through this. First of all, I've already talked about fourth patriarch. He was named Upagupta. I looked it up and I said, how do they even know this? This goes so far back. And it is amazing what is available on Google about Upagupta. You know, it's like... And we're going to go through the circumstances of how all of this happens. And this is, you've got to remember the time when this was, 300 BCE, roughly in that area, you know. But Upagupta is very famous, actually. He's famous for two things. First of all, those of you, again, that know Buddhism may have known of the ruler called Ashoka in India. You know, Ashoka was what they called a sage ruler. In fact, the story goes that he fought lots of wars in order to get territory, and all of a sudden he questioned, why am I doing this? This is, you know, this is obviously not the right thing to do. He had a big questioning. And then he realized all of a sudden he saw the Dharma. And Upagupta is credited by being his counsel, by being his teacher, if you like, of the Dharma. So this is where Upagupta comes from. So just coming back to Ashoka, the ruler, Ashoka was so, he was only really discovered in the 18th century in India, because the reason why was the script, under which we can sort of trace history, which was called the Brahmi script, was only really readable as of the 18th century. That's when they started, when scholars started reading it. And all of a sudden they discovered through all the various archaeological finds and the scripture that Ashoka was a huge ruler. And he ruled not just India, his empire went all the way to Afghanistan, from Afghanistan all the way to Bangladesh. So it was a huge territory in those days. And he is credited with having built many Buddhist stupas, and he is credited with having really, promoted Buddhism or the Dharma. In those days, there was no such thing called Buddhism, it was just the Dharma. He promoted the Dharma all over this area. And even still today, you go to Afghanistan, you go to these various countries in the Middle East, you will find archaeological sites that not only reference Ashoka, but also the Dharma, and the Buddha and various other things like that. So it's a very, very interesting history. So this is a bit of background. So the fourth patriarch was the Venerable Upagupta. He attended Chanavasa for 3 years, then shaved his head and became a monk. So shaving your head is like, that's the symbol. You shave your head and you become a monastic. That is the symbol. Once the Venerable Upagupta asked him, so he asked Chanavasa, did you make your home departure physically or in spirit? Sorry, I should say, once the Venerable asked him, did you make your home departure physically or in spirit? Okay. So home departure is like a monk or a nun, a monastic, they leave home. That home departure, of course, the Buddha was, some would say, the first monastic. He created the Sangha, which is the first monastic order. For history buffs, interestingly, the Sangha is the longest living community still existent today. Like that is how far back that goes as well, as the Buddhist Sangha, if you like. So that was the question. Did you make your home departure physically or in spirit? Did you make it physically or in spirit? And the master replied, truly, I made my home departure physically. And then Upagupta said, the Venerable Upagupta said, how can the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas have anything to do with body and mind? On hearing this, the master was greatly awakened. So here we have a simple phrase. How can the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas have anything to do with body or mind? And that triggered off an awakening process. What's interesting is, and those of you that have listened to the Teishos and familiar with koans, it's always a trigger point. And that trigger point can seem to those that don't see it a really banal, almost like, really? Like, really? And another awakening because of that? Someone, shouts, or someone hears a noise of a raindrop against a bamboo and they're awakened, and here someone says this and they're awake. Really? Is it that? It's a little bit like that, But people forget the process. The process is what we call, what the difference between that sudden and gradual awakening. As I always say, the gradual is there before the sudden. So here we have an example of sudden awakening. He hears this and goes, oh my gosh, he heard this. I myself, and I've shared this many times, had an experience where someone said something to me and the penny dropped. That was a moment of absolute clarity. Just somewhere, if I repeat it, which I have many times, it doesn't make sense. Well, it might make sense, but it's not like we're all going to get enlightened because of it. And that's why you cannot get enlightenment from books. Or everyone can write it down, and there's so many books out there about this, But unless you're ready for the penny to drop, you're not going to get it, That's why books and dogma does not satisfy, as I keep on saying, because we haven't got it. So this is what this is about. He got it at that moment. And so, of course, causes and conditions brought him to that moment where he got it, you know. And so it's the same with all of us. You know, we are in many ways producing karma as we go along. We are producing causes and conditions, you know. And eventually we may get it, we may not get it. That's how it works. Okay. On hearing this, the master greatly got awakened. On my second lecture this afternoon, I'll talk about that process. What are the goals of Zen and how do we achieve that in more detail? Okay, now we come to the circumstances. Now, these circumstances are a bit spooky. They they are out there, okay? They're out there, I can say that. But that's what makes them so interesting. And what makes it interesting is, like, you can read this and just put it away and say, nah, this is ancient gobbledygook, I don't want to have anything to do with this. But when you start paying attention and you look at it, you will see that actually nothing has changed from the way it was in those days to the way it is today. They had the same issues than we have today. The only thing that is different is the concepts that they use and the language that they use. So we might discard that because we have a modern language and we have renewed concepts that we deal with. But if you actually persevere and look into this in more detail, you'll find a great richness here. Okay. What is also interesting, when I looked up Upagupta, those circumstances that are mentioned in here, which I'll go through in a minute, they are documented. There's actually one Tibetan master that made a thesis on this guy, wrote a thesis. And they are replicated, like this is obviously not just some Kaizen dreaming this up in the 12th century. Kaizen was 12th century. Where he got that information from, I got no idea. But it is obviously being studied now and verified through archaeology and all that sort of thing. Okay, anyway, the master was from the land of Dali, and his name was Upagupta. So he's the one we're interested in. So he, Upagupta, he belonged to the Shudra class, the lowest of the four social classes. At the age of 15, he visited Chanavasta, so this is his teacher. At 17, he made his home departure, so it's very young, as they were in those days, already determined to do his home departure. Just on that, home departure is a really interesting phrase. It occurred to me when I was doing this, you know, what is our home? You know, home. We reference home with family, okay? But you can also reference home with self. Your true home is yourself. So if your home departure is letting go of self, doesn't necessarily mean your family. You always have family, whether there are brothers and sisters in the monastery or actual family as in children and husband and wives and all of this, you know. So you can look at home departure also from this is the goal, is to realize or go beyond self. Remember, that's what the Buddha has discovered. No self, as he called it, or non-self. Okay. So in many ways, you know, as lay people, as a householder lineage, which we are, you know, home departure is also what we're doing. So please look at it also from that perspective. So he made his home departure, and at 22 he acquired the fruit of practice. So the fruit of practice is this awakening moment. Okay, that doesn't necessarily mean, and again, you know, we say the fruit of practice, he's been enlightened. People look at enlightenment from different perspectives. If you've had an opening, if you had some idea, you know, an opening as far as seeing your true nature, you might have just had a moment of clarity. Some people call that awakening, you know. In our tradition, awakening is a process that takes a whole life. You know, it is, you start off with a reference point of what it is, and then the clarification process starts, which takes a long time to clarify. So it's that clarification process. So at 17, he may have had a really big awakening experience, But has he integrated it into his life or not? We don't know that. Okay, could be, maybe, maybe not. You know. Okay, traveling about and so let me read this again. At the age of 15, he visited Shanavasa. At 17, he made his home departure, and at 22, he acquired the fruit of practice. Traveling about and converting others, in other words, he was teaching, he arrived at Mathura, and the number of those who became monks and nuns, I presume, was exceedingly great. As a result of that, the palace of a demon shook. The palace. So many monks and nuns became converted, and the palace of the demon shook. Okay. So what do we make of that? The palace of the demon shook. So the demon here, we could look at the demon as in Mara in Buddhism, as like Satan or the devil in Christianity. But I like to ask you a question. Who are your demons? What demons have you got? What core beliefs hold you back from seeing clarity? So demons is not necessarily something as in, oh yeah, in ancient times they believed in demons. We all have demons, but we do give them different names. We might give a demon the name of anxiety or fear, or we might give the demon another name, like monkey mind. Who's controlling us? What is this monkey mind? There's another death, another death. Just don't get hung up on the word demon. You know. So demons, in a way, or monkey mind, or fears, we just have different words for this. Not only that, but you now look at, you look at the demons, if you like, or the negative influences that you'd like to call it. It goes right into our society, just like it did in those days. So we might look at, for instance, what are the demons that are out there today that are almost institutionalized? So we might look at politics. You look at what is happening in world politics today. We can easily see that there are elements out there that we might consider as demons or might consider as unwholesome. Whatever you want to call it. Then there's the embodiment of it. So again, looking at maybe in the corporate world, you know, the oligarchs, we might say, this is an embodiment of, you know, someone that is not good, you know, excessive greed, you know, all of these sorts of things. So if you have a demon in your life, or if we have a demon in our life, there's a problem. We have just created a demon, you know. So what's the opposite of a demon? It's a saint. So we differentiate between saint and demon. We polarize. That's what we do. And while we are in this polarization, in this framework of polarizing, you know, good versus bad, or demon versus saint, you know, or Labour Party versus Liberal Party, or Republicans versus Democrats, while we are, or Middle East versus whatever, while we are demonizing this, while we are polarizing this, we don't get it. We are trapped there. And it goes around, that's samsara. It goes around and around and around. We look for the good, but we reject the bad. So what he's saying here is the palace of the demon shook. Meaning it crumbled. There was so much awakening happening in those days that all of a sudden we see through what a demon is. There's no such thing. It is something that is created in our mind. It's a story that we have. Same with saints. You know. So the core of our being is being shaken up. So that's the way you can look at this. The core of our being is being shaken up because what breaks down is these core beliefs that we have. What breaks down is this dualism that we get caught in. And trembled, so the demon shook and trembled, or the palace of the demon shook, even a palace, a house of cards that we build up, you know, shook. and trembled, and the demon grieved and was afraid. He was afraid of survival. They want to survive. Our ego, you know, we can see that. I mean, I can see it myself, you know. There's a certain part of me that doesn't want to let go. I want to be right. I've had this core belief. I don't want to let it go because otherwise I'm wrong. You know, it starts shaking. It starts shaking. And it's afraid of letting go. You know. Each time someone was enlightened, Upagupta tossed a tally 4 inches in length into a stone room. The room was 18 cubits high and 12 cubits square, and it was filled with tallies. 1 cubit is equal to about 2 feet. Upagupta was cremated with the tallies accumulated from a lifetime of encouraging home departure. The number of people who made their home departure was as great as when the Tathagata was alive. So the number of people that became monastics was as great then, those days, as when the Buddha was alive. And there were a lot from all accounts. Therefore, people called him the Buddha without major and minor marks. So he was a Buddha, but he didn't have the marks of him. The demon, okay, resentful, watched for a time. So here we anthropomorphize the demon. We make him somehow as a being, you know. So the demon resentful, like he's a resentful being. We make him a being, you know. The devil is all of a sudden a being. That's what we do. Even though aspects of ourselves, we create these images. So the demon resentful watched for a time when Upagupta entered samadhi, which is deep concentration. Then, exercising his demonic powers, he tried to harm the true Dharma. So exercising his demonic powers is like when we sit in meditation and I'm concentrating and the monkey mind comes in. That's it. Exercising demonic powers. It's just a different language. It's just all of a sudden, the monkey mind is, where does it come from? Is it demonic? Of course, nowadays, we, through psychology, we've evolved and we know that these are aspects of our, you know, shadows, if you like. These are aspects of ourselves. And the Venerable, while in samadhi, saw what was intended. He saw what was intended. It's like these are hindrances. Another way of explaining that is like the hindrances come up. Of course, they called them demonic in those days, but the hindrances come up. And we can see what's happening. We can see that this is just a causality of thoughts that comes in that tries to, you know, get in the way of us concentrating. And whether that is concentrating on cooking or driving or sitting on our cushion, you know, we continuously have this issue with getting distracted, you know, from this whatever it is, from ourselves. And he saw what was intended. The demon watched and secretly hung a garland around Upagupta's neck. So he was a very tricky demon. He hung a garland on his neck. And again, you know, don't we do that as well? Where we make a deal, like those of you that maybe have a Christian tradition, you know, I used to make a deal with God. If I do that, then I want you to do that, you know. It's a little bit like that, he made a deal with him, you know. He tried to somehow manipulate him. Then the Venerable Upagupta had the idea of subduing him. Okay. Rising from samadhi, he took the dead bodies of a human being, a dog, and a snake, and transformed them into a flower garland. Okay. Speaking softly, he put the demon at ease, saying, "You offered me a very rare and wonderful garland, and now I have a garland that I want to offer you in return." So he transformed a human being, a dog, and a snake into a flower garland. And again, we are doing exactly the same thing in our practice. When we see through, in many ways, when we see through the concepts and the illusion that our mind creates. Once we see through that, once we see that there is no demon, that demon is just a word, demon, from that moment on, that demon is nothing other than a flower garland. It has got no more power. It's got the same power as a glass of water. And this is what he did. You know, it's very powerful, and we can do that. When you look at the words that we use and that we are attached to, that create all the anxiety that we have, once we see through all of that, it's all a flower garland. There is no demon. There is no good. There is no bad. It's all a flower garland once we see through that. The demon was very happy. The demon was very happy and extended his neck to receive it. Then the garland changed back into three smelly corpses. Insects and worms crawled from them. The demon detested it and was greatly distressed. He could not get rid of it despite his supernatural powers, nor could he unfasten or move it. You know, and that happens, you know, we get stuck. We get stuck in the monkey mind, and sometimes it seems impossible to move it. Then he rose up. So this is the demon. Then he rose up to the six heavens. Now we're getting into Buddhist cosmology. Then he rose up to the six heavens of realms of desire and spoke to the celestial beings. He also visited the Brahma heavens and sought deliverance. The celestial beings said, "This is a supernatural transformation done by a disciple, you know, like a superhuman. It's spiritual. It's done by a disciple of the Buddha who has the 10 powers. We are ordinary beings. So what can we do about it?" And the demon then said, "What can I do?" And the Brahma celestials told him to take refuge with Upagupta, you know, to integrate, basically taking refuge to integrate with Upagupta. And then he would be able to get rid of the garland. They recited this verse in order to change his mind. So here's the verse. "If you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. Trying to get up without the ground makes no sense. Return and seek liberation from a disciple with the 10 powers." Having received this instruction, the demon left the celestial mansion and in repentance paid homage at the feet of the Venerable Upagupta. The Venerable Upagupta asked him, "Are you going to ever try to harm the Tathagata's true dharma? The truth, are you ever going to interfere with the truth again?" The demon replied, "I completely take refuge in the Buddha way and will forever cease what is not good." The Venerable Upagupta said, "In that case, you must say that you take refuge in the three treasures." And the demon king joined his hands and pronounced the formula for taking refuge three times, and the garland fell off. So the message here, the garland fell off, is absolute commitment. I mean, for that garland of the demons, whatever words we like to ascribe to the garland, but for us to see through all of that, you know, that requires some kind of commitment. That's the message that I got out of this. So this is the circumstance about Upagupta in ancient India. So next comes the Taisho, which is a Kaizen. This, now we're moving to the 12th century. So he now comes in, 12th century. So still Middle Ages. You know, he comes in and he gives his take on this. And also, this is a doozy. This is not an easy one to. This pushes buttons. This particular Taisho, but this is one of the wonderful things about Kaizen. So now he goes on. In this way, Upagupta displayed the powerful effects of the Buddha Dharma. causes and conditions. The powerful effect of the Dharma is nothing other than cause and effect. Just as when the Tathagata was alive, when he was 17 years old and shaved his head, Shanavasta asked him, "Did you make your home departure physically or in spirit?" So we're getting to the koan here. That's what the koan is about. Did you make your home departure physically or in spirit? Kaizen says, for Buddhists, there are basically two forms of departure, which are physical and mental. Leaving home physically means that they cast away love and affection. Leaving home physically means that they cast away love and affection. So family, you know, that family life, cast away love and affection. Leaving their homes and birthplaces, shave their heads, don monks' or nuns' robes, do not have male or female servants, become monks or nuns, and make an effort in the way throughout the 24 hours of each day. Whatever the time, they do not pass in vain. And when you look at monastics today, I mean, that is full-time commitment to doing this. There's a full-time commitment to attaining, awakening, leaving home. In other words, leaving all attachments. You know, they're starting off, imagine having no children, having no possessions. To start off at that base is, you know, to let go of attachment is already... It's in many ways, you could say, it's a great advantage to start off at that, from that perspective. They do not pass in vain, so they're really fully committed to it. They desire nothing else, so that is like that real full faith and absolute commitment. They neither delight in life nor fear death. Their minds are as pure as the autumn moon, and their eyes are as clear as the bright mirror, no dust. They do not seek mind, nor do they hanker to see original nature. This is important. They do not seek mind. You know, and we hear that as well. They all type of seek, there's just being, all type of seeking. If you seek, there's a me that is seeking, and there's something to be thought. They do not seek anything. They're just completely just in their practice, just mu, just the breath, whatever our object of concentration is. Not getting involved in any type of intellectual, am I seeking something, am I not seeking something? Their minds are as pure as the autumn moon. Their eyes are as clear as a bright mirror. They do not seek mind, nor do they hanker to see original nature or Buddha nature. They do not cultivate the holy truth, much less worldly attachments. See, as soon as we cultivate holy truth, we fall back into polarity. Then there must be an unholy truth. So there must be something. If I'm looking for the holy truth, there must be something out there that is not holy. There is, as soon as I'm trapped there, I can keep looking and looking and looking. So this, they're already at that point where they can see that, much less worldly attachment. In this way, they do not abide in the stage of ordinary folk or cherish the rank of the wise and the holy. So ordinary folk, of course, are attached. They're attached to all sorts of things. This is this way of explaining the conditioning that we all inhabit, but more and more become mindless seekers of the way. So mindless here, not mindless, mindless as in no mind. They seek with no mind, mindless like that, of the way. These are people who leave home physically. So this is how he describes his own, in many ways, his own monastic tradition. Okay, from a Soto perspective. Those who live home in spirit, oh, it's interesting. Those who live home in spirit do not shave their heads or wear monk's clothing, even though they live at home and remain among worldly cares. They are like lotuses which are not soiled by the mud in which they grow. So, you know, this very much relates to can relate to us. You know, even though we live in the world of family and the household, you know, like we live in the world of delusions. The image here is a lotus in muddy water. The lotus is a sign of enlightenment. The mind, the muddy water is a sign of delusion. So, like a lotus in muddy water. So you got these two aspects, you know. So you live right amongst all the delusion, or nirvana and samsara. These are other words for it. Even though they live at home and remain among worldly cares, they are like lotuses, enlightened, if you like, which are not soiled, possible to soil, by the mud, by whatever is happening in the world, they are not soiled by it. Not soiled by the mud in which they grow, or jewels which are immune to contamination by dust. So this is, you know, this is of course the ideal, you know, if we can, and we do that, you know, we live in the world of day-to-day Brisbane, Australia, with all the worries, you know, and our monkey mind as active as ever, to be able to see through all of that, to be able to see that the muddy waters, you know, is nothing other than it itself. To be able to see that, that is total freedom. Freedom to live no matter where we are, whether we are monks or no monks, whether we are fathers or mothers or whatever. You know, to be able to live in and have a state of mind that is completely free, that sees the world from this perspective of form and emptiness, emptiness and form. Perspective that form is nothing other than that all form, no matter what it is, including the demons that we all have, is nothing other than it, and it is nothing other than form. That is what he is describing. Even though there are karmic conditions, he says, we all have different karmic conditions. Every one of us has a different conditioning, so that they have wives and children. Some people have children, some people have no children, some people live here, some people live there. They consider them trash and dust. Now, this might push a few buttons. Even though there are karmic conditions so that they have wives and children, they consider them trash and dust. I remember reading this thinking, whoa, like... There's a jolt here, okay. And that is, and again, this is the invitation. This is the power of this teisho that Kaizen is giving us here, to be able to look at that. Why did he say that? What is trash? What is dust? You know, the only reason we maybe get hung up on this is because we are clinging. Again, we are being polarized by trash and dust, or love and hate. We are falling into this polarization. You know. I remember a long time ago, I realized that love hurts. You know, love hurts. If you really love someone, it hurts. You know. And what is it actually that hurts? You know. What hurts is the thought of separating. That's what hurts, you know. But when you in this practice, we're invited to go beyond this conventional way of looking at separation. There is no way that we are separated. There is no way that we can ever be separated. That is what we get when we have an awakening experience, that you see that. And in that moment you see that love or hate separates. And in that moment we are looking through. That doesn't mean that we don't love and that we don't hate. Of course we do. This is just love or just hate. But the attachment falls completely away. There's just love, or there's just hate. you know, without this story or without this ideology behind it. And at that moment, love no longer hurts. You know, it is, you could say it's pure, you know, whatever. These are just words that you hang on top of it, you know. So this is what we can get out of this when he says that, when we look into it. They consider them trash and dust. It's like trash and dust. What is all of this? It's all trash and dust. It's all energy. It's all energy that we call paper or Scott, you know, or Lee. It's all energy, you know. But no, it's Maggie. It's not energy. Or it's Arno. It's not energy. It's not love. It's not hate. It's love. But ultimately, what is all of this? You know, this is what we need to look at. They do not entertain love for even a moment or covet anything. That's what he's saying. So they do not entertain love because love is a concept. They see through it. Of course, we use the word love and hate in order to communicate. But when we see through it, when we see through it what it really is, we are liberated from it. And if we don't, we are attached. And that's where we remain. That is where we remain if we are attached to it. And of course, that's not easy. This really pushes buttons, you know. To what degree do we let go? You know, people get scared of letting go, you know, because they think all of a sudden that they lose love or they lose attachment. Believe me, I don't believe that you can ever lose attachment, but you see through it. Doesn't mean you don't love your children or your wife or your husbands anymore. You see through it or you see what it is. Rather than being caught by it. Like the moon suspended in the sky like a ball rolling around a tray, they live in the noisy city and see the one who is tranquil. So, a beautiful description. They see the one who is tranquil, meaning they see the whole of existence. You see the whole thing. Not just, I hate this person and I love this person. They see the whole thing throughout the whole. They see through the whole thing. That's what he's referring to. In the midst of the three realms, past, present, future, three realms. In the midst of the three realms, they clarify the fact that they dwell beyond time. There is no past, no present, no future. But we're stuck by it. We somehow seem to be stuck by past. We are looking everything through the prism of past, present, and future. Our anxieties are nothing other than being fueled by these three realms, past, present, and future. If you wouldn't have past, present, or future, your anxieties are gone. So we are stuck in this paradigm of past, present, and future, even though even scientists have proven there is no such thing. And here, 2,500 years ago, they already discovered that. As an experiential fact. To realize that there is only one thing. He calls it one thing. There's only one whole existence beyond the small me. Coming back to energy and whatever it is we would call emptiness. There's so many different words for it. They clarify the fact that they dwell beyond time. And this. Now, clarify the fact that they dwell beyond time. And that doesn't mean that all of a sudden we are living in la-la land. You know, clarifying the fact that they live beyond time in samsara, in other words, we are living in non-duality, but in the context of duality, it is the duality that makes life interesting. It is the duality that gives it spice, you know. But there is no such thing. It's like, That famous saying, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is emptiness. Form is all form is energy. All form is all emptiness. So what is emptiness? Right here. It's emptiness. Form. Or Lee. Or Gary. It's nothing other. Form is emptiness, emptiness is what it is. There's nothing other than that. They clarify the fact that they dwell beyond time. This is the clarification. This is the integration of it. They realize that exterminating the passions is a sickness, and that aiming for ultimate reality is wrong. So exterminating the passion, there's this whole thing, oh, we must do this. There's nothing we must do. It's just a realization that passion is like love. There's nothing wrong with passion. There's nothing wrong with love. There's nothing wrong with hate. These are facts of life. You know, it's like they realize, they see through all of that. And exterminating one for the other, you just fall back into this polarization thing. It's a sickness. And they aim for ultimate reality. Aim for ultimate reality? What? Aim for emptiness? Be in emptiness? Just dwell in emptiness? They don't understand. What is emptiness? Emptiness is nothing other than form, which is the passion again, the love again. You know. They realize that both nirvana and samsara are illusions. They're just concepts. That's just a way of explaining it, because we need to have some contrast to explain things. But ultimately, they're illusions. And they are not attached to either enlightenment or the passions. These are people who leave home in spirit, he says. Shanavasa asked Upagupta whether he had made his home departure physically or in spirit. If it is not one or the other, then home departure is not home departure, he says. Hence the question. However, Upagupta replied, truly, it was physical home departure. In other words, he left home. How can there be anything else? I left home. It was home departure. That's what he said. It was physical home departure. In this, he did not think about mind. He didn't get philosophical about it, speak of original nature, or discuss the abstruse. He just knew that he was the body composed of the four elements and five aggregates that left home. It's a conventional way. It's just that's what happened. He attained enlightenment spontaneously. All of a sudden he got it. He saw the whole of existence all at once, and therefore clarified that it was a matter of psychic powers. Now, here the word is psychic powers. Today we would say it was a paradigm shift, or we might use it was a matter of whatever words we use today. You know, it's this realignment of neurons or whatever neurology goes into. Kensho, we use the word Kensho. We have a Kensho experience. He acquired it without seeking. You cannot find it by seeking, you know, and therefore clarified the fact that it's unobtainable. It's unobtainable because it's always there. How can you obtain something you already got? It's just a matter of seeing it. It's always there. That's why it's unobtainable. Since this was the way it was, he said that he had left home physically. However, from the standpoint of the Buddha's wondrous Dharma, this is not the explanation. Therefore, Shanavasa explained that Buddhas do not leave home physically or in spirit, nor should they be seen in terms of the four elements or the five aggregates, nor seen as the profound mystery of truth. So here it goes on, you know, once again we get trapped in the duality of it. If we're looking at it that way, they cannot be seen in terms of the wise and the foolish, and they are not bound by such things as mind and body or conditions, you could say. They are like space, which is neither inside nor outside. That's nice. They're like space, like Buddhas. They're like space. There's neither inside nor outside. If you go into space, where's inside? Where's outside? You know, where's inside? Where's outside? Like the ocean, which has neither surface nor interior. So once you don't hold on to one thing, once you don't hold on to any type of polarity, there is neither outside nor... You need a reference point of this is where I am, then you have inside, then you have outside, then you have this, then you have linear. You need this linear way of looking at it. But once you're outside this time and space paradigm, once you're outside the linear, there's no such thing. Even though there are many subtle principles in numerous teachings, he spoke only of this. Do not say that I am the Honored One is Buddha, and do not say that he either comes or goes. Now, coming, going, these are, again, that's where words, that's why words are so difficult, because we get trapped all the time in this conventional way of looking at things. Who can speak of before my parents were born? Which is a koan, by the way. Who can speak of before my parents were born or prior to the empty eon? Aiming at this place, one transcends birth and no birth. Again, birth and no birth. I've talked many times about this. I won't go over this again. One is liberated from mind and no mind. It's like water conforming to its container, like space which rests against things. Though you grasp it, your hands are not filled. Though you search for it, you cannot find a trace. This is the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas. When you reach this place, Upagupta does not exist and Chanavasa does not arise. So when you reach this place, we don't exist. This is, we are just a concept that our story is made up. So you cannot consider them to move or be still or come or go, even though there is and is not, other and self. It is like a sound at the bottom of a stream. I love this. It's like me and you, you, cushion, whatever it is, table. If we really see it, there's just sound. There's no table. Table. That's it. Table. It's just sound. It's like a sound at the bottom of the stream, or like an end, or the endlessness of space. If you do not experience this place one time, now this is the challenge. We all should experience at least once. This we should all have this realization at least once. And he says, if you do not experience this place one time, then even a million teachings and countless wonderful principles will end up uselessly as the flow of ordinary karmic consciousness. In other words, we're trapped. We are just continuously going around and around in samsara without having that experience. In this way, when Chanavasa spoke about this and Upagupta was instantly awakened, it was like a clap of thunder in a clear sky, like a raging fire bursting out on the great earth. Once the thunder roared, not only was it as if the roots of Upagupta's ears were cut off, but he instantly lost the root of his life. So he lost the root of his life. He realized that, he realized total emptiness, the root of, what root? What root of his life? What is our root? Where do we come from? Where's the root of our life? So he saw through that. The raging fire blazed suddenly, and the Buddha's teachings and the true face of the ancestral teachers were completely reduced to ashes. So it's all, everything reduced to ashes. Everything is energy. The whole thing is reduced to ashes. The whole thing, he saw that. Ashes. These ashes appear with the name of Venerable Upagupta. This energy appears as Gary, you know, as Raph, as Melissa, as water. Standing, eating. It just appears as that. We get hung up on it, this energy. So the ashes, it's a beautiful description of dependent origination. Everything is ash in a way. Everything is ash. And then it reappears again, over and over again. They were as hard as stone, black as lacquer, getting rid of the ordinary natures of any number of people and smashing their bodies. He vainly counted emptiness by casting tallies and left behind traces of emptiness by burning emptiness. That refers back to the koan. Today, this descendant, so this is now Kaizen speaking. Today, this descendant, Daijo, would like to look for the traces beyond the clouds and fix some words to the clear sky. Isn't that beautiful? Today, you know, I want to look beyond the clouds Like he obviously sees this emptiness of it, you know, but he wants to fit some words on the clear sky, which is always problematic, you know, because words, they obstruct, you know, they obstruct. You see the clarity, then a word comes in, why? Or could it be? And, oh, immediately we get caught in the words, you know. So that's what he's saying, you know. Today, this descendant of Diageo would like to look for the traces beyond the clouds and fix some words to the clear sky. Would you like to hear them? And now comes his beautiful verse. He's famous for his verses. House demolished. The house, what? The house is demolished. Like the bucket is open, nothing there. The house demolished. No self, non-self, whatever you want to call it. The person perished, neither inside nor outside. House demolished, the person perished, neither inside nor outside. It's nearly lunchtime. I've been talking for too long. Where can body and mind hide their form? Where can body and mind hide their form? Right here.